you shall have no cause to complain of this justice of mine that you say is proverbial. State in your own words the nature of the breach in discipline that has brought all this on.
Excellence, my duty is primarily to the state, and not to my living the life of a retired merchant mariner upon the world of Caligan. My instructions were to direct Foundation activity upon the planet, perfect an organization to act as check upon the warlord of Caligan, particularly as regards his foreign policy.
This is known to me. Continue.
Excellence, my reports have continually stressed the strategic positions of Caligan and the systems it controls. I have reported on the ambition of the warlord, his resources, his determination to extend his domain, and his essential friendliness, or perhaps neutrality, toward the Foundation. I have read your reports thoroughly. Continue.
Excellence, I returned 2 months ago. At that time, there was no sign of impending war, no sign of anything but an almost superfluity of ability to repel any conceivable attack. 1 month ago, an unknown soldier of fortune took Caligan without a fight. The man who was once warlord of Caligan is apparently no longer alive. Men do not speak of treason. They speak only of the power and genius of this strange condottiere, this mule.
This who?
The mayor leaned forward and looked offended.
Excellence, he is known as the mule. He is spoken of little, in a factual sense, but I have gathered the scraps and fragments of knowledge and winnowed out the most probable of them. He is apparently a man of neither birth nor standing. His father unknown. His mother dead in childbirth. His upbringing that of a vagabond. His education that of the tramp worlds and the backwash alleys of space. He has no name other than that of the mule, a name reportedly applied by himself to himself and signifying, by popular explanation, his immense physical strength and stubbornness of purpose.
What is his military strength, Captain? Never mind his physique.
Excellence, men speak of huge fleets, but in this they may be influenced by the strange fall of Caligan. The territory he controls is not large, though its exact limits are not capable of definite determination. Nevertheless, this man must be investigated.
So.
The mayor fell into a reverie, and slowly, with 24 strokes of his stylus, drew 6 squares in hexagonal arrangements upon the blank top sheet of a pad, which he tore off, folded neatly in 3 parts, and slipped into the waste paper slot at his right hand. It slid towards a clean and silent atomic disintegration.
Now then, tell me, Captain, what is the alternative?
You have told me what must be investigated.
What have you been ordered to investigate?
Excellence, there is a rat hole in space that, it seems, does not pay its taxes.
Ah, and is that all? You are not aware, and have not been told, that these men who do not pay their taxes are descendants of the wild traders of our early days. Anarchists, rebels, social maniacs who claim Foundation ancestry and deride Foundation culture. You are not aware and have not been told that this rat hole in space is not one, but many. That these rat holes are in greater number than we know. That these rat holes conspire together, one with the other, and all with the criminal elements that still exist throughout Foundation territory. Even here, Captain. Even here.
The mayor's momentary fire subsided quickly.
You are not aware, Captain?
Excellence, I have been told all this. But as servant of the state, I must serve faithfully. And he serves most faithfully who serves truth. Whatever the political implications of these dregs of the ancient traders,
The warlords who have inherited the splinters of the old empire have the power. The traitors have neither arms nor resources. They have not even unity. I am not a tax collector to be sent on a child's errand.
Captain Pritcher, you are a soldier, and count guns. It is a failing to be allowed you up to the point where it involves disobedience to myself. Take care. My justice is not simply weakness. Captain, it has already been proven that the generals of the Imperial Age and the warlords of the present age are equally impotent against us. Selden's science, which predicts the course of the Foundation, is based not on individual heroism, as you seem to believe, but on the social and economic trends of history. We have passed successfully through 4 crises already, have we not?
Excellence, we have.
Yet Selden's science is known only to Selden. We ourselves have but faith. In the first 3 crises, as I have been carefully taught, the Foundation was led by wise leaders who foresaw the nature of the crises and took the proper precautions. Otherwise, who can say?
Yes, Captain, but you omit the 4th crisis.
Come, Captain, we had no leadership worthy of the name then, and we faced the cleverest opponent, the heaviest armor, the strongest force of all. Yet we won by the inevitability of history.
Excellence, that is true.
But this history you mention became inevitable only after we had fought desperately for over a year. The inevitable victory we won cost us 500,000 ships and 500,000 men.
Excellence, Selden's plan helps those who help themselves.
Mayor Indber frowned and grew suddenly tired of his patient exposition. It occurred to him that there was a fallacy in condescension, since it was mistaken for permission to argue eternally, to grow contentious, to wallow in dialectic. He said stiffly, "Nevertheless, Captain, Selden guarantees victory over the warlords, and I cannot, in these busy times, indulge in a dispersal of effort. These traitors you dismiss are Foundation-derived. A war with them would be a civil war. Selden's plan makes no guarantee there for us, since they and we are Foundation. So they must be brought to heel. You have your orders."
"Excellence, you have been asked no question, Captain. You have your orders. You will obey those orders. Further argument of any sort with myself or those representing myself will be considered treason. You are excused."
Captain Han Pritcher knelt once more, then left with slow, backward steps. Mayor Indber, 3rd of his name and 2nd mayor of Foundation history to be so by right of birth, recovered his equilibrium and lifted another sheet of paper from the neat stack at his left. It was a report on the saving of funds due to the reduction of the quantity of metal foam edging on the uniforms of the police force. Mayor Indber crossed out a superfluous comma, corrected a misspelling, made 3 marginal notations, and placed it upon the neat stack at his right. He lifted another sheet of paper from the neat stack at his left. Captain Han Pritcher of Information found a personal capsule waiting for him when he returned to barracks. It contained orders, terse and redly underlined with a stamped urgent across it, and the whole initialed with a precise capital I. Captain Han Pritcher was ordered to the rebel world called Haven in the strongest terms. Captain Han Pritcher, alone in his light one-man speedster, set his course quietly and calmly for Calgan. He slept that night the sleep of a successfully stubborn man. Chapter 13. Lieutenant and Clown. If, From a distance of 7,000 parsecs, the fall of Kalgan to the armies of the Mule had produced reverberations that had excited the curiosity of an old trader, the apprehension of a dogged captain, and the annoyance of a meticulous mayor. To those on Kalgan itself, it produced nothing and excited no one. It is the invariable lesson to humanity that distance in time, and in space as well, lends focus. It is not recorded, incidentally, that the lesson has ever been permanently learned. Kalgan was Kalgan. It alone of all that quadrant of the galaxy seemed not to know that the Empire had fallen, that the Stannels no longer ruled, that greatness had departed, and peace had disappeared. Kalgan was the luxury world. With the edifice of mankind crumbling, it maintained its integrity as a producer of pleasure, a buyer of gold, and a seller of leisure. It escaped the harsher vicissitudes of history, for what conqueror would destroy or even seriously damage a world so full of the ready cash that would buy immunity? Yet even Kalgan had finally become the headquarters of a warlord, and its softness had been tempered to the exigencies of war. Its tamed jungles, its mildly modeled shores, and its garishly glamorous cities echoed to the march of imported mercenaries and impressed citizens. The worlds of its province had been armed and its money invested in battleships rather than bribes for the first time in its history. Its ruler proved beyond doubt that he was determined to defend what was his and eager to seize what was others. He was a great one of the galaxy, a war and peacemaker, a builder of empire, an establisher of dynasty. And an unknown with a ridiculous nickname had taken him, and his arms, and his budding empire, and had not even fought a battle. So Kalgan was as before, and its uniformed citizens hurried back to their older life, while the foreign professionals of war merged easily into the newer bands that descended. Again, as always, there were the elaborate luxury hunts for the cultivated animal life of the jungles that never took human life, and the speedster bird chases in the air above that was fatal only to the great birds. In the cities, the escapers of the galaxy could take their varieties of pleasure to suit their purse, from the ethereal sky palaces of spectacle and fantasy that opened their doors to the masses at the jingle of half a credit, to the unmarked, unnoted haunts, to which only those of great wealth were of the cognoscenti. To the vast flood, Torin and Beta added not even a trickle. They registered their ship in the huge common hangar on the East Peninsula and gravitated to that compromise of the middle classes, the inland sea, where the pleasures were yet legal and even respectable, and the crowds not yet beyond endurance. Beta wore dark glasses against the light and a thin white robe against the heat. Warm-tinted arms, scarcely the goldener for the sun, clasped her knees to her, and she stared with firm, abstracted gaze at the length of her husband's outstretched body, almost shimmering in the brilliance of white sun splendor. "Don't overdo it," she had said at first, but Torin was of a dying red star. Despite 3 years of the Foundation, sunlight was a luxury, and for 4 days now his skin, treated beforehand for ray resistance, had not felt the harshness of clothing, except for the brief shorts. Beta huddled close to him on the sand, and they spoke in whispers. Torin's voice was gloomy as it drifted upwards from a relaxed face. "No, I admit we're nowhere. But where is he? Who is he? This mad world says nothing of him. Perhaps he doesn't exist." "He exists," replied Beta, with lips that didn't move. "He's clever, that's all. And your uncle is right. He's a man we could use, if there's time." A short pause. Torin whispered, "Know what I've been doing, Bay? I'm just daydreaming myself into a sun stupor. Things figure themselves out so neatly, so sweetly. His voice nearly trailed off, then returned. Remember the way Dr. Aman talked back at College Bay? The Foundation can never lose, but that does not mean the rulers of the Foundation can't. Didn't the real history of the Foundation begin when Salver Hardin kicked out the encyclopedists and took over the planet Terminus as the first mayor? And then, in the next century, didn't Hober Mallow gain power by methods almost as drastic? That's twice the rulers were defeated, so it can be done. So why not by us? It's the oldest argument in the books, Tori. What a waste of good reverie.
Is it? Follow it out.
What's Haven? Isn't it part of the Foundation? If we become top dog, it's still the Foundation winning, and only the current rulers losing. Lots of difference between we can and we will. You're just jabbering.
Torin squirmed.
Nuts, Bay. You're just in one of your sour green moods. What do you want to spoil my fun for?
I'll just go to sleep if you don't mind.
But Beta was craning her head, and suddenly, quite a non sequitur, she giggled and removed her glasses to look down the beach with only her palm shading her eyes.
Torin looked up, then lifted and twisted his shoulders to follow her glance.
Apparently she was watching a spindly figure, feet in air, who teetered on his hands for the amusement of a haphazard crowd. It was one of the swarming acrobatic beggars of the shore, whose supple joints bent and snapped for the sake of the thrown coins. A beach guard was motioning him on his way, and with a surprising one-handed balance, the clown brought a thumb to his nose in an upside-down gesture. The guard advanced threateningly and reeled backward with a foot in his stomach. The clown righted himself without interrupting the motion of the initial kick and was away, while the frothing guard was held off by a thoroughly unsympathetic crowd. The clown made his way raggedly down the beach. He brushed past many, hesitated often, stopped nowhere. The original crowd had dispersed. The guard had departed.
"He's a queer fellow," said Beta with amusement, and Torin agreed indifferently.
The clown was close enough now to be seen clearly. His thin face drew together in front into a nose of generous planes and fleshy tip that seemed all but prehensile. His long, lean limbs and spidery body, accentuated by his costume, moved easily and with grace, but with just a suggestion of having been thrown together at random. To look was to smile. The clown seemed suddenly aware of their regard, for he stopped after he had passed, and with a sharp turn, approached. His large brown eyes fastened upon Beta. She found herself disconcerted. The clown smiled, but it only saddened his beaked face, and when he spoke, it was with the soft, elaborate phrasing of the central sectors.
"Were I to use the wits the good spirits gave me," he said, "then I would say, this lady cannot exist. For what sane man would hold a dream to be reality? Yet rather would I not be sane and lend belief to charmed, enchanted eyes."
Beta's own eyes opened wide. She said, "Wow."
Torin laughed. "Oh, you enchantress. Go ahead, Bay. That deserves a 5-credit piece. Let him have it."
But the clown was forward with a jump.
"No, my lady, mistake me not. I spoke for money not at all, but for bright eyes and sweet face."
"Well, thanks." Then to Torin, "Golly, you think the sun's in his eyes?"
"Yet not alone for eyes and face," babbled the clown as his words hurled past each other in heightened frenzy,
"but also for a mind, clear and sturdy, and kind as well."
Torin rose to his feet, reached for the white robe he had crooked his arm about for 4 days, and slipped into it.
"Now, bud," he said, "suppose you tell me what you want and stop annoying the lady."
The clown fell back a frightened step, his meager body cringing.
"No, sure I meant no harm. I am a stranger here, and it's been said I am of addled wits.
Yet there is something in a face that I can read. Behind this lady's fairness there is a heart that's kind, and that would help me in my trouble for all I speak so boldly.
"Will 5 credits cure your trouble?" said Torrin dryly, and held out the coin.
But the clown did not move to take it, and Beta said, "Let me talk to him, Tori."
She added swiftly and in an undertone, "There's no use being annoyed at his silly way of talking. That's just his dialect, and our speech is probably as strange to him."
She said, "What is your trouble?"
"You're not worried about the guard, are you? He won't bother you."
"Oh, no, not he. He's but a windlet that blows the dust about my ankles.
There is another that I flee, and he is a storm that sweeps the worlds aside and throws them plunging at each other.
A week ago I ran away, have slept in city streets and hid in city crowds. I've looked in many faces for help in need. I find it here."
He repeated the last phrase in softer, anxious tones, and his large eyes were troubled.
"I find it here."
"Now," said Beta reasonably, "I would like to help, but really, friend, I'm no protection against a world-sweeping storm. To be truthful about it, I could use..." There was an uplifted, powerful voice that bore down upon them.
"Now then, you mud-spawned rascal."
It was the beach guard with a fire-red face and snarling mouth that approached at a run. He pointed with his low-power stun pistol.
"Hold him, you two. Don't let him get away."
His heavy hand fell upon the clown's thin shoulder so that a whimper was squeezed out of him.
Torrin said, "What's he done?"
"What's he done?
What's he done? Well, now that's good." The guard reached inside the dangling pocket attached to his belt and removed a purple handkerchief, with which he mopped his bare neck. He said with relish, "I'll tell you what he's done. He's run away." The word's all over Calgan, and I would have recognized him before this if he had been on his feet instead of on his hawk-face top. And he rattled his prey in a fierce good humor. Beta said with a smile, "Now where did he escape from, sir?" The guard raised his voice. A crowd was gathering, pop-eyed and jabbering, and with the increase of audience, the guard's sense of importance increased in direct ratio. "Where did he escape from?" he declaimed in high sarcasm. "Why, I suppose you've heard of the mule now." All jabbering stopped, and Beta felt a sudden iciness trickle down into her stomach. The clown had eyes only for her. He still quivered in the guard's brawny grasp.
"And who," continued the guard heavily, "would this infernal ragged piece be but his lordship's own court fool who's run away?"
He jarred his captive with a massive shake. "Do you admit it, fool?" There was only white fear for answer, and the soundless sibilance of Beta's voice close to Torrin's ear. Torrin stepped forward to the guard in friendly fashion. "Now, my man, suppose you take your hand away for just a while. This entertainer you hold has been dancing for us and has not yet danced out his fee."
"Here," the guard's voice rose in sudden concern. "There's a reward.
You'll have it, if you can prove he's the man you want. Suppose you withdraw till then. You know that you're interfering with a guest, which could be serious for you."
"But you're interfering with his lordship, and that will be serious for you."
He shook the clown once again.
"Return the man's fee, carrion."
Torrin's hand moved quickly, and the guard's stun pistol was wrenched away, with half a finger nearly following it. The guard howled his pain and rage. Torrin shoved him violently aside, and the clown, unhanded, scuttled behind him. The crowd, whose fringes were now lost to the eye, paid little attention to the latest development.
There was among them a craning of necks and a centrifugal motion as if many had decided to increase their distance from the center of activity. Then there was a bustle and a rough order in the distance. A corridor formed itself and two men strode through, electric whips in careless readiness. Upon each purple blouse was designed an angular shaft of lightning with a splitting planet underneath. A dark giant in lieutenant's uniform followed them, dark of skin and hair and scowl. The dark man spoke with the dangerous softness that meant he had little need of shouting to enforce his whims. He said, "Are you the man who notified us?" The guard was still holding his wrenched hand, and with a pain-distorted face mumbled, "I claim the reward, your mightiness, and I accuse that man." "You'll get your reward," said the lieutenant, without looking at him. He motioned curtly to his men, "Take him." Torrin felt the clown tearing at his robe with a maddened grip. He raised his voice and kept it from shaking. "I'm sorry, Lieutenant. This man is mine." The soldiers took the statement without blinking. One raised his whip casually, but the lieutenant's snapped order brought it down. His dark mightiness swung forward and planted his square body before Torrin. "Who are you?" And the answer rang out, "A citizen of the Foundation." It worked. With the crowd, at any rate. The pent-up silence broke into an intense hum. The mule's name might excite fear, but it was, after all, a new name, and scarcely stuck as deeply in the vitals as the old one of the Foundation that had destroyed the Empire, and the fear of which ruled a quadrant of the galaxy with ruthless despotism. The lieutenant kept face. He said, "Are you aware of the identity of the man behind you?" "I have been told he's a runaway from the court of your leader, but my only sure knowledge is that he is a friend of mine. You'll need firm proof of his identity to take him." There were high-pitched sighs from the crowd, but the lieutenant let it pass. "Have you your papers of Foundation citizenship with you?" "At my ship." "You realize that your actions are illegal?" "I can have you shot." "Undoubtedly. But then you would have shot a Foundation citizen, and it is quite likely that your body would be sent to the Foundation, quartered, as part compensation. It's been done by other warlords." The lieutenant wet his lips. The statement was true. He said, "Your name?" Torrin followed up his advantage. "I will answer further questions at my ship. You can get the cell number at the hangar. It is registered under the name Beta." "You won't give up the runaway?" "To the mule, perhaps. Send your master." The conversation had degenerated to a whisper, and the lieutenant turned sharply away. "Disperse the crowd," he said to his men with suppressed ferocity. The electric whips rose and fell. There were shrieks and a vast surge of separation and flight. Torrin interrupted his reverie only once on their way back to the hangar. He said almost to himself, "Galaxy Bay, what a time I had. I was so scared." "Yes," she said with a voice that still shook and eyes that still showed something akin to worship. "It was quite out of character." "Well, I still don't know what happened. I just got up there with a stun pistol that I wasn't even sure I knew how to use, and talked back to him. I don't know why I did it." He looked across the aisle of the short-run air vessel that was carrying them out of the beach area to the seat on which the mule's clown scrunched up in sleep, and added distastefully, "It was the hardest thing I've ever done." The lieutenant stood respectfully before the colonel of the garrison, and the colonel looked at him and said, "Well done. Your part's over now." But the lieutenant did not retire immediately. He said darkly, "The mule has lost face before a mob, sir. It will be necessary to undertake disciplinary action to restore a proper atmosphere of respect." Those measures have already been taken. The lieutenant half turned, then almost with resentment, "I'm willing to agree, sir, that orders are orders. But standing before that man with his stun pistol and swallowing his insolence whole was the hardest thing I've ever done." Chapter 14. The Mutant. The hangar on Calgan is an institution peculiar unto itself, born of the need for the disposition of the vast number of ships brought in by the visitors from abroad, and the simultaneous and consequent vast need for living accommodations for the same. The original bright one who had thought of the obvious solution had quickly become a millionaire. His heirs, by birth or finance, were easily among the richest on Calgan. The hangar spreads fatly over square miles of territory, and hangar does not describe it at all sufficiently. It is essentially a hotel for ships. The traveler pays in advance, and his ship is awarded a berth from which it can take off into space at any desired moment. The visitor then lives in his ship, as always. The ordinary hotel services, such as the replacement of food and medical supplies at special rates, simple servicing of the ship itself, special intra-Calgan transportation for a nominal sum, are to be had, of course. As a result, the visitor combines hangar space and hotel bill into one at a saving. The owners sell temporary use of ground space at ample profits. The government collects huge taxes. Everyone has fun. Nobody loses. Simple. The man who made his way down the shadow borders of the wide corridors that connected the multitudinous wings of the hangar had in the past speculated on the novelty and usefulness of the system described above. But these were reflections for idle moments, distinctly unsuitable at present. The ships hulked in their height and breadth down the long lines of carefully aligned cells, and the man discarded line after line. He was an expert at what he was doing now, and if his preliminary study of the hangar registry had failed to give specific information beyond the doubtful indication of a specific wing, one containing hundreds of ships, his specialized knowledge could winnow those hundreds into one. There was the ghost of a sigh in the silence as the man stopped and faded down one of the lines, a crawling insect beneath the notice of the arrogant metal monsters that rested there. Here and there, the sparkling of light from a porthole would indicate the presence of an early returner from the organized pleasures to simpler or more private pleasures of his own. The man halted and would have smiled if he ever smiled. Certainly the convolutions of his brain performed the mental equivalent of a smile. The ship he stopped at was sleek and obviously fast. The peculiarity of its design was what he wanted. It was not a usual model, and these days most of the ships of this quadrant of the galaxy either imitated Foundation design or were built by Foundation technicians. But this was special. This was a Foundation ship, if only because of the tiny bulges in the skin that were the nodes of the protective screen that only a Foundation ship could possess. There were other indications, too. The man felt no hesitation. The electronic barrier strung across the line of the ships as a concession to privacy on the part of the management was not at all important to him. It parted easily and without activating the alarm at the use of the very special neutralizing force he had at his disposal. So the first knowledge within the ship of the intruder without was the casual and almost friendly signal of the muted buzzer in the ship's living room that was the result of a palm placed over the little photocell just one side of the main airlock. And while that successful search went on, Torin and Beta felt only the most precarious security within the steel walls of the Beta. The mule's clown, who had reported that within his narrow compass of body he held the lordly name of Magnifico Giganticus, sat hunched over the table and gobbled at the food set before him. His sad brown eyes lifted from his meal only to follow Beta's movements in the combined kitchen and larder where he ate. "The thanks of a weak one are of but little value," he muttered, "but you have them. For truly in this past week little but scraps have come my way, and for all my body is small, yet is my appetite unseemly great." "Well then, eat," said Beta with a smile. "Don't waste your time on thanks. Isn't there a central galaxy proverb about gratitude that I once heard?" "Truly there is, my lady. For a wise man, I have been told, once said, gratitude is best and most effective when it does not evaporate itself in empty phrases. But alas, my lady, I am but a mass of empty phrases, it would seem. When my empty phrases pleased the mule, it brought me a court dress and a grand name. For see you, it was originally simply Bobo, one that pleases him not. And then, when my empty phrases pleased him not, it would bring upon my poor bones beatings and whippings." Torrin entered from the pilot room. "Nothing to do now but wait, Bay. I hope the mule is capable of understanding that a Foundation ship is Foundation territory." Magnifico Giganticus, once Bobo, opened his eyes wide and exclaimed, "How great is the Foundation before which even the cruel servants of the mule tremble!" "Have you heard of the Foundation, too?" asked Beta, with a little smile. "And who has not?" Magnifico's voice was a mysterious whisper. "There are those who say it is a world of great magic, of fires that can consume planets, and secrets of mighty strength. They say that not the highest nobility of the galaxy could achieve the honor and deference considered only the natural due of a simple man who could say, 'I am a citizen of the Foundation,' were he only a salvage miner of space, or a nothing like myself." Beta said, "Now, Magnifico, you'll never finish if you make speeches. Here, I'll get you a little flavored milk. It's good." She placed a pitcher of it upon the table and motioned Torrin out of the room. "Tori, what are we going to do now? About him?" And she motioned toward the kitchen. "How do you mean?" "If the mule comes, are we going to give him up?" "Well, what else, Bay?" He sounded harassed, and the gesture with which he shoved back the moist curl upon his forehead testified to that. He continued impatiently, "Before I came here, I had a sort of vague idea that all we had to do was to ask for the mule and then get down to business. Just business. You know, nothing definite." "I know what you mean, Tori. I wasn't much hoping to see the mule myself, but I did think we could pick up some first-hand knowledge of the mess and then pass it over to people who know a little more about this interstellar intrigue. I'm no storybook spy." "You're not behind me, Bay." He folded his arms and frowned. "What a situation. You'd never know there was a person like the mule except for this last queer break. Do you suppose he'll come for his clown?" Beta looked up at him. "I don't know that I want him to. I don't know what to say or do, do you?" The inner buzzer sounded with its intermittent burring noise. Beta's lips moved wordlessly. "The mule." Magnifico was in the doorway, eyes wide, his voice a whimper. "The mule?" Torrin murmured, "I've got to let them in." A contact opened the airlock and the outer door closed behind the newcomer. The scanner showed only a single shadowed figure. "It's only one person," said Torrin, with open relief, and his voice was almost shaky as he bent toward the signal tube. "Who are you?" "You'd better let me in and find out, hadn't you?" The words came thinly out the receiver.
I'll inform you that this is a Foundation ship and consequently Foundation territory by international treaty.
I know that.
Come with your arms free or I'll shoot. I'm well armed.
Done.
Torrin opened the inner door and closed contact on his blast pistol, thumb hovering over the pressure point. There was the sound of footsteps, and then the door swung open, and Magnifico cried out,
"It's not the mule. It's but a man."
The man bowed to the clown somberly. "Very accurate. I'm not the mule." He held his hands apart. "I'm not armed, and I come on a peaceful errand. You might relax and put the blast pistol away. Your hand isn't steady enough for my peace of mind."
"Who are you?" asked Torrin brusquely.
"I might ask you that," said the stranger coolly, "since you're the one under false pretenses, not I."
"How so?"
"You're the one who claims to be a Foundation citizen when there's not an authorized trader on the planet."
"That's not so. How would you know?"
"Because I am a Foundation citizen, and have my papers to prove it. Where are yours?"
"I think you'd better get out."
"I think not. If you know anything about Foundation methods, and despite your imposture, you might, you'd know that if I don't return alive to my ship at a specified time, there'll be a signal at the nearest Foundation headquarters. So I doubt if your weapons will have much effect, practically speaking." There was an irresolute silence, and then Beta said calmly,
"Put the blaster away, Torrin, and take him at face value. He sounds like the real thing."
"Thank you," said the stranger. Torrin put his gun on the chair beside him.
"Suppose you explain all this now?"
The stranger remained standing. He was long of bone and large of limb. His face consisted of hard, flat planes, and it was somehow evident that he never smiled. But his eyes lacked hardness. He said news travels quickly, especially when it is apparently beyond belief. "I don't suppose there's a person on Caligan who doesn't know that the mule's men were kicked in the teeth today by two tourists from the Foundation. I knew of the important details before evening, and as I said, there are no Foundation tourists aside from myself on the planet. We know about those things."
"Who are the we?"
"We are we. Myself, for one. I knew you were at the hangar. You had been overheard to say so. I had my ways of checking the registry and my ways of finding the ship." He turned to Beta suddenly. "You're from the Foundation. By birth, aren't you?"
"Am I?"
"You're a member of the Democratic Opposition. They call it the Underground. I don't remember your name, but I do the face. You got out only recently, and wouldn't have if you were more important."
Beta shrugged. "You know a lot."
"I do. You escaped with a man. That one."
"Does it matter what I say?"
"No. I merely want a thorough mutual understanding. I believe that the password during the week you left so hastily was Selden, Hardin, and Freedom. Porphyrat Hart was your section leader."
"Where'd you get that?"
Beta was suddenly fierce.
"Did the police get him?"
Torrin held her back, but she shook herself loose and advanced. The man from the Foundation said quietly, "Nobody has him. It's just that the Underground spreads widely and in queer places. I'm Captain Han Pritcher of Information, and I'm a section leader myself. Never mind under what name." He waited, then said, "No, you don't have to believe me. In our business, it is better to overdo suspicion than the opposite. But I'd better get past the preliminaries."
"Yes," said Torrin. "Suppose you do."
"May I sit down?"
"Thanks."
Captain Pritcher swung a long leg across his knee and let an arm swing loose over the back of the chair. I'll start out by saying that I don't know what all this is about, from your angle. You two aren't from the Foundation, but it's not a hard guess that you're from one of the independent trading worlds. That doesn't bother me over much. But out of curiosity, what do you want with that fellow? That clown you snatched to safety. You're risking your life to hold on to him. I can't tell you that. Well, I didn't think you would. But if you're waiting for the mule himself to come behind a fanfare of horns, drums, and electric organs, relax. The mule doesn't work that way. What? It came from both Torin and Beta, and in the corner where Magnifico lurked with ears almost visibly expanded, there was a sudden, joyful start. That's right. I've been trying to contact him myself and doing a rather more thorough job of it than you two amateurs can. It won't work. The man makes no personal appearances, does not allow himself to be photographed or simulated, and is seen only by his most intimate associates. Is that supposed to explain your interest in us, Captain? Questioned Torin. No. That clown is the key. That clown is one of the very few that have seen him. I want him. He may be the proof I need, and I need something, Galaxy knows, to awaken the Foundation. It needs awakening, broke in Beta with sudden sharpness. Against what? And in what role do you act as alarm, that of rebel Democrat or of secret police and provocateur? The captain's face set in its hard lines. When the entire Foundation is threatened, Madam Revolutionary, both Democrats and tyrants perish. Let us save the tyrants from a greater that we may overthrow them in their turn. Who's the greater tyrant you speak of? Flared Beta. The mule. I know a bit about him. Enough to have been my death several times over already if I had moved less nimbly. Send the clown out of the room. This will require privacy. Magnifico, said Beta, with a gesture, and the clown left without a sound. The captain's voice was grave and intense, and low enough so that Torin and Beta drew close. He said, the mule is a shrewd operator. Far too shrewd not to realize the advantage of the magnetism and glamour of personal leadership. If he gives that up, it's for a reason. That reason must be the fact that personal contact would reveal something that is of overwhelming importance not to reveal. He waved aside questions and continued more quickly. I went back to his birthplace for this, and questioned people who, for their knowledge, will not live long. Few enough are still alive. They remember the baby born 30 years before, the death of his mother, his strange youth. The mule is not a human being. And his two listeners drew back in horror at the misty implications. Neither understood fully or clearly, but the menace of the phrase was definite. The captain continued, he is a mutant, and obviously from his subsequent career a highly successful one. I don't know his powers or the exact extent to which he is what our thrillers would call a Superman, but the rise from nothing to the conqueror of Kalgan's warlord in 2 years is revealing. You see, don't you? The danger? Can a genetic accident of unpredictable biological properties be taken into account in the Selden plan? Slowly, Beta spoke. I don't believe it. This is some sort of complicated trickery. Why didn't the mule's men kill us when they could have if he's a Superman? I told you that I don't know the extent of his mutation. He may not be ready yet for the Foundation, and it would be a sign of the greatest wisdom to resist provocation until ready. Now, let me speak to the clown.
The captain faced the trembling Magnifico, who obviously distrusted this huge, hard man who faced him. The captain began slowly. "Have you seen the mule with your own eyes?" "I have but too well, respected sir, and felt the weight of his arm with my own body as well."
"I have no doubt of that.
Can you describe him?"
"It is frightening to recall him, respected sir. He is a man of mighty frame. Against him even you would be but a spindling. His hair is of a burning crimson, and with all my strength and weight I could not pull down his arm once extended, not a hair's thickness."
Magnifico's thinness seemed to collapse upon itself in a huddle of arms and legs.
"Often, to amuse his generals or to amuse only himself, he would suspend me by one finger in my belt from a fearful height while I chattered poetry. It was only after the 20th verse that I was withdrawn, and each improvised and each a perfect rhyme, or else start over. He is a man of overpowering might, respected sir, and cruel in the use of his power. And his eyes, respected sir, no one sees."
"What? What's that last?"
"He wears spectacles, respected sir, of a curious nature. It is said that they are opaque and that he sees by a powerful magic that far transcends human powers. I have heard," and his voice was small and mysterious, "that to see his eyes is to see death. That he kills with his eyes, respected sir."
Magnifico's eyes wheeled quickly from one watching face to another. He quavered,
"It is true. As I live, it is true."
Beta drew a long breath.
"Sounds like you're right, Captain. Do you want to take over?"
"Well, let's look at the situation. You don't owe anything here? The hangar's barrier above is free?"
"I can leave any time."
"Then leave. The mule may not wish to antagonize the Foundation, but he runs a frightful risk in letting Magnifico get away. It probably accounts for the hue and cry after the poor devil in the first place. So there may be ships waiting for you upstairs. If you're lost in space, who's to pin the crime?"
"You're right," agreed Torrin bleakly. "However, you've got a shield, and you're probably speedier than anything they've got. So as soon as you're clear of the atmosphere, make the circle in neutral to the other hemisphere. Then just cut a track outwards at top acceleration."
"Yes," said Beta coldly. "And when we are back on the Foundation, what then, Captain?"
"Why, you are then cooperative citizens of Kalgan, are you not?"
"I know nothing to the contrary, do I?"
Nothing was said. Torrin turned to the controls. There was an imperceptible lurch. It was when Torrin had left Kalgan sufficiently far in the rear to attempt his first interstellar jump that Captain Pritchard's face first creased slightly. For no ship of the Mule had in any way attempted to bar their leaving.
"Looks like he's letting us carry off Magnifico," said Torrin.
"Not so good for your story."
"Unless," corrected the captain, "he wants us to carry him off. In which case it's not so good for the Foundation."
It was after the last jump, when within neutral flight distance of the Foundation, that the first hyperwave news broadcast reached the ship. And there was one news item barely mentioned. It seemed that a warlord, unidentified by the board speaker, had made representations to the Foundation concerning the forceful abduction of a member of his court. The announcer went on to the sports news. Captain Pritchard said icily, "He's one step ahead of us after all." Thoughtfully, he added, "He's ready for the Foundation, and he uses this as an excuse for action. It makes things more difficult for us." We will have to act before we are really ready.
Chapter 15. The Psychologist. There was reason to the fact that the element known as pure science was the freest form of life on the Foundation. In a galaxy where the predominance and even survival of the Foundation still rested upon the superiority of its technology, even despite its large access of physical power in the last century and a half, a certain immunity adhered to the scientist. He was needed, and he knew it. Likewise, there was reason to the fact that Ebling Meese, only those who did not know him added his title as to his name, was the freest form of life in the pure science of the Foundation. In a world where science was respected, he was the scientist, with capital letters and no smile. He was needed, and he knew it. And so it happened that when others bent their knee, he refused and added loudly that his ancestors in their time bowed no knee to any stinking mayor. And in his ancestors' time, the mayor was elected anyhow and kicked out at will, and that the only people that inherited anything by right of birth were the congenital idiots. So it also happened that when Ebling Meese decided to allow Inber to honor him with an audience, he did not wait for the usual rigid line of command to pass his request up and the favored reply down, but having thrown the less disreputable of his two formal jackets over his shoulders and pounded an odd hat of impossible design on one side of his head and lit a forbidden cigar into the bargain, he barged past two ineffectually bleating guards and into the mayor's palace. The first notice His Excellence received of the intrusion was when from his garden he heard the gradually nearing uproar of expostulation and the answering bull roar of inarticulate swearing. Slowly Indber laid down his trowel. Slowly he stood up, and slowly he frowned. For Indber allowed himself a daily vacation from work, and for 2 hours in the early afternoon, weather permitting, he was in his garden. There in his garden the blooms grew in squares and triangles, interlaced in a severe order of red and yellow, with little dashes of violet at the apices, and greenery bordering the whole in rigid lines. There in his garden no one disturbed him. No one. Indber peeled off his soil-stained gloves as he advanced toward the little garden door. Inevitably, he said, "What is the meaning of this?" "It is the precise question and the precise wording thereof that has been put to the atmosphere on such occasions by an incredible variety of men since humanity was invented. It is not recorded that it has ever been asked for any purpose other than dignified effect." But the answer was literal this time, for Meese's body came plunging through with a bellow and a shake of a fist at the ones who were still holding tatters of his cloak. Indber motioned them away with a solemn, displeased frown, and Meese bent to pick up his ruin of a hat, shake about a quarter of the gathered dirt off it, thrust it under his armpit, and say, "Look here, Indber. Those unprintable minions of yours will be charged for one good cloak. Lots of good wear left in this cloak." He puffed and wiped his forehead with just a trace of theatricality. The mayor stood stiff with displeasure and said haughtily from the peak of his 5'2", "It has not been brought to my attention, Meese, that you have requested an audience. You have certainly not been assigned one." Ebling Meese looked down at his mayor with what was apparently shocked disbelief. "Galaxy, Indber, didn't you get my note yesterday? I handed it to a flunky in purple uniform day before. I would have handed it to you direct, but I know how you like formality." "Formality?" Indber turned up exasperated eyes. Then, strenuously, "Have you ever heard of proper organization?
At all future times, you are to submit your request for an audience, properly made out in triplicate, at the government office intended for the purpose. You are then to wait until the ordinary course of events brings you notification of the time of audience to be granted. You are then to appear, properly clothed. Properly clothed, do you understand? And with proper respect, too. You may leave.
What's wrong with my clothes? Demanded Meese hotly.
Best cloak I have.